This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday, the 25th of September. The head of the Israeli army has given the most explicit indication yet that his forces intend to mount a ground invasion into Lebanon. We'll hear from our correspondent in northern Israel, from the Israel Defense Forces, and as the Prime Minister tells British citizens in Lebanon to leave the country now, we'll speak to two women weighing up their options. Also, the government wants to get people on long-term sickness benefits back to work. We examine the challenges of doing that. As Michael Gove is named as a new editor of The Spectator, what does his appointment and the magazine's new owner tell us about the direction of Britain's conservative media? Plus, is too much screen time creating a generation of short-sighted children? After the deadliest week of fighting between Lebanon and Israel for many years, is the conflict in the Middle East about to grow even wider, even less predictable? That is the fear being expressed by world leaders who are gathering in New York for the UN General Assembly, where attempts to reach a ceasefire, much like the fighting on the ground, are now happening on multiple fronts. It comes as the Israeli military has given its most explicit sign yet that it is planning for a ground invasion of Lebanon, the first since the 34-day war of 2006. This is what the IDF's Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Hetzi Halevi, told soldiers along Israel's northern border today.
You hear the jets overhead. We have been striking all day. This is both to prepare the ground for your possible entry and to continue degrading Hezbollah. Today, Hezbollah expanded its range of fire, and later today, they will receive a very strong response. Prepare yourselves.
Well, that came as large-scale Israeli airstrikes continued across Lebanon today, killing dozens of people. The Iranian-backed Hezbollah militia has returned some fire, and that included early in the morning, local time, launching a ballistic missile towards Israel's biggest city, Tel Aviv, a first. Well, that missile was intercepted by Israeli air defence. We can speak now to our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, who's in northern Israel. Paul, a noticeable shift in the mood music and in the rhetoric in the last, 48, but certainly in the last 24 hours. What more do we know about the possibility of a ground incursion?
Not a great deal, James, but clearly today did mark a shift because we had the head of the army, as you just played that clip, saying publicly for the first time that Israeli troops may end up on the ground inside southern Lebanon. This is something that the head of Israel's northern command is said to favour, the creation of some kind of buffer zone along the northern border. And so here we have someone on camera, the head of the army, saying that this could happen. The reason, obviously, is because I think there is a recognition that despite the absolute pounding that the Israeli Air Force is delivering and has been delivering for the last several days on Hezbollah's forces in southern Lebanon and elsewhere in Lebanon, the notion that you can clear them away from the border adequately without sending troops in is pretty unlikely. We were in Kiryat Shmona, just north of here, right next to the Lebanese border earlier today. We saw a town deserted. We saw rockets fired from across the border being intercepted overhead. Reminders that the situation along the border remains completely untenable. And the Israeli government is saying emphatically that its war aim, its principal war aim, frankly, at the moment, is to bring Israeli citizens back to their homes along the northern border. And it is unlikely that that can happen without some kind of either diplomatic breakthrough or, if that doesn't work, some kind of military incursion on the ground.
The most recent one, though, in 2006, it does not have good memories for Israel, does it?
no one with any institutional memory within the Israeli Defense Forces will relish the prospect of going back into southern Lebanon. There was the war in 2006, but of course, before that, in the 80s and 90s, a 20-year occupation of southern Lebanon, an attempt to create an ally with the Christian forces in Lebanon. It all cost a great deal of blood and treasure. The Israeli public became profoundly disillusioned with it, and eventually in the year 2000 the Israeli military pulled out. I remember watching the last Israeli soldier closing the gate as the troops finally left, much to their and the Israeli public's relief. So if the government is thinking of going back in on the ground now, it is going to have to sell this in a way that the Israeli public will buy. I think the Israeli public obviously wants to see an end to Hezbollah rockets across the border and that for citizens to be allowed to go back to their homes. But they will want to know that this is limited, both in perhaps geographical scope, but also in time.
Paul, many thanks. Our correspondent Paul Adams in northern Israel. We can speak now to Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, who is the international spokesman of the Israel Defence Forces. Good evening.
Good evening, James.
Is some kind of ground incursion now inevitable?
Inevitable, I think, is a very drastic word. Of course, the IDF needs to take the necessary preparations, and that's what General Halevi was saying to the troops earlier today. We've had two brigades that have been in reserve that have been recruited, and we are rallying our forces and preparing them for that eventuality if it does actually need to happen. I think Paul was definitely right on point where he talked about 60,000 Israelis being evacuated for the last year, and the primary route to try and bring them home was diplomacy. But unfortunately, that has not been realized. And now the government has instructed us to make the preparations to ensure that Israelis can get back home safely.
You would acknowledge, though, wouldn't you, both that historical issue that Paul talked about, the 2006 experience was not a comfortable one for Israel, a 34-day war that was essentially fought to a stalemate. I think more than 100 troops perished in that war. And you will know that since then, Hezbollah have been preparing for something like this. They have had 18 years. They are battle-hardened. They have, it's believed, 20,000 fighters there in southern Lebanon. It is one thing to carry out these airstrikes. It is another thing to send your troops across the border on the ground.
Absolutely. We don't take it lightly. I would say the fact that Israel has been trying to negotiate for the last year a safe and secure return of the people to their homes, I think illustrates that perfectly. But we need to keep in mind, you know, as you said, they've accumulated more rockets and missiles and drones than most Western countries today. They are and have been launching over 9,500 rockets, missiles and drones in the last year towards Israel. That's intolerable. And, you know, the people of Israel need to be able to get home safely. We would have watched and...
But isn't the way to do that is to negotiate, to reach an agreement that brings a ceasefire in Gaza, because that is what Hezbollah says has led them to sending the rockets across into Israel. It's all linked, isn't it? That's where things are going to end.
James, they chose to link that. There is no connection between the war in Gaza, which Hamas initiated on the 7th of October, and the war that Hezbollah initiated on the 8th of October.
So do you believe if there is a ceasefire in Gaza, it does not necessarily mean that Hezbollah would stop their fighting?
Of course not. And why? And would you, in your right mind, go live back in the north with that looming threat constantly on your border, on your homes, on your houses, on your schools? Of course not. We need a new reality. And what Paul was saying about 2006, you know, that war ended with the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1701, which was supposed to ensure with United Nations peacekeepers on the border that Hezbollah does not have weapons in the south of Lebanon so that they cannot pose the threat. In the first month of this war, Hezbollah launched 7 attempts to infiltrate into Israel, just like on the 7th of October.
Can I ask about the timing? Clearly, this is happening while the UN General Assembly is happening. We're seeing that Presidents Biden and Macron are discussing ceasefire efforts in Lebanon at this moment. This could be seen to be essentially a way of putting pressure on other countries to do more. Is it a genuine threat or genuine possibility that boots will be on the ground, or is this part of a broader attempt to put pressure on Israel's allies to do more?
I think the military, hope is not a method from our perspective. We need to be prepared to mobilize if we're given that instruction. Of course, the diplomats need to deal with the diplomacy and the military needs to deal with the war fighting. We are determined to degrade and destroy Hezbollah's capability to pose a threat of the 7th of October on our northern communities, on the towns, on the kibbutzim, on the villages. And at this stage, I think that what is most important is that we bring the people home. They need, we need to achieve our goals. Of course, we're not trying and have done extensive efforts to try and avert this escalation. But unfortunately, this is where we are.
Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, international spokesperson for the IDF. Thanks very much.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Well, as we reported last night, several hundred members of the British Armed Forces have gone to Cyprus in preparation for a possible evacuation of UK nationals from Lebanon. The BBC understands there are between 4,000 and 6,000 of them currently in the country. That includes dependents. Well, when he was asked by Chris Mason what his message was to them, Sir Keir Starmer's reply today was blunt.
Leave now. It's very important. The situation is escalating. We need the situation to de-escalate. But I say to British nationals, don't wait. Leave now. We are ramping up the contingency plans for an evacuation, as you would expect. But my message is, don't wait for that. There are commercial flights still coming out. It is important to leave and to leave now. And through you, I really want to get that message across.
Well, many of those who are still in Lebanon remain divided about whether to heed that advice from the Prime Minister. Hayat Fakhouri is a British-Lebanese dual national who lives in Beirut, although she has moved in with a friend at the moment because she fears that her own house might be hit by Israeli airstrikes. But she's hoping that she won't have to leave the country.
I mean, my life is here. I've lived here for the last 15 to 20 years. My family's here. My loved ones are here. My work is here. I do not feel at the moment that I want to leave my home.
Some in your family have decided to, though, haven't they?
Yes, most of them actually have. My mother is here, my father's here, and two of my aunts are still here. If things escalate, we as a family have to reconsider things. It's kind of a tough situation to be in because we don't really know how long this is going to be, how intense this, it feels very intense actually, but we don't really know how long it's going to be. So it's a very confusing state to be in.
Now, the top general in the Israel Defense Forces has said today to his troops to prepare for a possible ground invasion. I think it's the first time that's been said so explicitly by a top commander. Does that worry you?
It is definitely something that I'm scared of. I don't know how far they're going to come in or what they're planning to do, but it's definitely something that we're all afraid of. For now, we're in Beirut. If we need to, we can move up to the mountains. We can move to safer areas. And if it becomes completely unsafe everywhere, then for me, that's when I will leave.
Hayat Fakhouri there. Meanwhile, in a town just outside Beirut, Rita, who asked us just to use her first name, has a British spousal visa and a biometric residence permit, or BRP. She is based in the UK and is trying to find a way to leave.
I'm married to a British citizen. I have my two boys in London. And I came to Lebanon, caring for a sick relative. I was here early in the summer. We had a contact from the FCDO before in early August. We were registered to leave in case of any emergency.
And now?
And now, I mean, when it escalated, the situation is becoming really bad. We didn't receive any message from the FCDO.
And your situation, you are living in Britain. You have a spousal visa. Does that give you the right, as far as you know, to be on an evacuation flight?
Yeah, I didn't have any objection about it.
So what is the situation at the moment? I understand you do have a ticket, but not for several days.
I do have a reservation on the 2nd of October. I just wanted to bring it earlier. I couldn't because the flights are fully booked. I have the option of leaving on Wednesday, next Wednesday, still on the 2nd, if the airport is still operating.
Your husband and your sons are back in London. How worried are they about you, though?
I mean, yeah, they phone every day. You know, like, we have a chat for an hour. You should leave. You have to take into consideration leaving by land, take a taxi to Turkey, just leave. I mean, my name is at the embassy. I'm registered in the FCDO program, but still they didn't contact me.
That was Rita speaking to us earlier from a town just outside the Lebanese capital. We did put her account to the Foreign Office for a response. They have pointed us towards an announcement made by the government tonight that it has reopened its service for British people in Lebanon to register their presence in order to make themselves known to the embassy there. And the government has also announced it is sending £5 million of humanitarian aid to Lebanon. The only way to get Britain growing again is to get Britain working again. Those were the words of the Work and Pensions Secretary Liz Kendall in her speech to the Labour Party conference today. The government is making welfare reform an important part of its growth agenda. One area it wants to address is a growing number of people aged between 16 and 64 who are economically inactive due to long-term sickness. The most recent ONS figure for the last quarter of last year is 2.8 million. That's up by 500,000 since 2019. This was Sir Keir Starmer's exchange with Nick Robinson on the Today programme.
Are you telling those who are out of work, who may think that they can't work, that the country has a right to expect that they look for work, they do everything they can to get work? That is the sacrifice they need to make.
Well, yes, of course. In relation to long-term sickness, which is at very high levels, then of course people need to look for work, but they also need support. And that's why I've gone out to look at schemes where businesses are supporting people back into work from long-term sickness.
So how feasible is it to get those on long-term sickness back to work? What needs to be put in place for employees and employers? I've been discussing that with Tony Wilson, who's director at the Institute of Employment Studies, an independent consultancy on human resources and employment, and with Tracy Evans, who worked as a care assistant and support worker for 30 years before she got ill. She claims PIP, or personal independence payments, type of disability benefit, and universal credit. And she told me why she'd stopped working.
I caught COVID in January 2021. I was working as a carer and I was rushed into hospital, put in ICU, was in a coma for 2 months, and I couldn't basically do anything for myself for quite a while. I tried going back to work after a year and a half of recovery and I lasted 3 weeks. So I let that go. And then I tried again recently this year as a family support worker, and I couldn't cope with that either because the fatigue and the brain fog, and because my hands don't work properly with the nerve damage, I can't cope.
You do get benefits, so that's how you're able to survive, is it?
Yes, I'm living on Universal Credit and PIP. It's $1,500 a month for the highest payment of PIP and Universal Credit. But it's not what I want to be because I've always worked. I worked for 30 years.
And what do you think when you hear the Prime Minister saying that he thinks that people who are claiming long-term sickness benefits should be expected to look for work?
I think it's disgusting. I just don't think he understands at all how it feels to be out of work. It isn't like we don't want to be in work. It's because we can't be in work. I'm sure people don't want to be off sick. I'm in a Facebook group for people with long COVID, And I hear every day nurses having to be let go, carers let go, any job. They can't function and it's destroying them. They've lost marriages, the homes, the jobs. It's not fair.
Tony Wilson, if I can bring you in, what do you think when you hear about Tracy's experience?
Well, firstly, I'm just so sorry to hear it. And it must be so hard, and particularly to have made those efforts to try to get back into work and, you know, get back to your job.
What do you think needs to be done then to support people to get back into work who have had long-term illnesses and are able to do so? What is it that businesses need to do to help employees get back into the office?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot more that we can do where people are able to work. And I think, you know, adapting jobs differently to better accommodate people's needs. So, I mean, if people have physical, like musculoskeletal conditions, like looking at how you can make adaptations to work so that people don't have to sit still for long periods, for example, you know, standing desks or other kinds of support. If people have poor mental health or depression, there's things we can do around more informal flexibilities, around the time spent at work, being able to take breaks, being able to start later or do shifts differently. The trouble is that firms often don't have particularly strong incentives to offer this. They don't face penalties, really, if they don't offer it.
Yes, I did want to ask you about that, because there are challenges for companies in the private sector as well, aren't there, in making these kind of adaptations. Do they need help as well? Does the government need to do stuff for the companies to enable them to be flexible enough?
Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. And this is a large part of the challenge here, is that we're not very good at doing that. There's a system called Access to Work, which can provide financial support, but Access to Work doesn't really follow the individual. Now, there have been efforts to try to broaden access to the right kinds of support, but I think businesses will say they're quite time poor.
Given what the government has been saying the last couple of days, are you concerned that they are going to be using more sticks than carrots when it comes to the workers who are on these long-term sickness benefits?
The important point here is we've got a system at the moment which has the strictest conditions for people who are unemployed, you know, people who don't meet the criteria for sort of ill health benefits. We've got among the strictest conditions in the world. So we've got a very like black and white system where if you're required to look for work, a lot is required. You're expected to spend 35 hours of every week and demonstrate you have spent 35 hours a week looking for work. On the other hand, if you're assessed as not being able to look for work, you have no requirements at all. And you often have no support either. And actually, I think, and the Office for Budget Responsibility have argued this could be happening too, as have the Institute for Fiscal Studies. I think part of the issue here is that the strictness of the requirements for people who are unemployed is meaning that people who have health conditions really have no choice but to apply for these benefits where the requirements don't exist.
Tracy, can I just sort of turn back to you? You're clearly not going to be able to go back to work, but I just wonder what your experience was like on those two occasions where you did try to go back. Did you feel supported? Were adaptations put in place to take into account your condition and the challenges you had?
Not really, because I went back into the care sector, which it's 12-hour shifts. You have to do 12-hour shifts. You can only have the allotted breaks. You can't have extra breaks. And I were running around all day long like you're doing care, and I couldn't cope, and I were tired. So I were lying and going to the bathroom to say I needed to go, but just for a rest.
Could you see yourself going back into the workforce, though, if you did have the right support in place?
No, what I'm trying to do at the moment now is try and see if I can try and work at home, because then at least I can pace myself and I can do what I want at home and do it when I want, have a rest when I want.
Tracy Evans, and before that we heard from Tony Wilson from the Institute of Employment Studies. It's an issue we keep coming back to on The World Tonight. We do like to hear from you about it, whether you're long-term out of work, perhaps on benefits, or indeed perhaps you run a business and can't find the workers you need to make your business tick or indeed grow. Just let us know. You can get in touch with us by text at 84844. The charge is 10 to 15 pence. We are also on WhatsApp 03700 100 444 or via email world.tonight@bbc.co.uk. Now, some seven-year-old boys want to be footballers, others want to be train drivers, but the seven-year-old Michael Gove, we are told by the man he is succeeding in his new job, wanted to be editor of The Spectator. The magazine's publisher, Freddie Sayers, confirmed today that the former Conservative cabinet minister has now realised his ambition half a century later. Mr Gove, who was a journalist for 17 years before he began his parliamentary career, will take over on October the 8th. His new job follows the purchase of the Bible of the Right, as it's known, by the co-owner of GB News, Sir Paul Marshall. And he will be starting his new job just a few weeks before the Conservative Party's new leader is announced. Well, we're joined now by Lionel Barber, former editor of the Financial Times, co-host of Media Confidential podcast, to discuss this development. Good evening, Lionel.
Good evening.
First of all, what do you make of Michael Gove's appointment?
Well, I think it's a rather imaginative appointment. I mean, he was a former journalist. He's not just a politician. He's not like George Osborne, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, who'd not been a journalist, then took over at the Evening Standard to be briefly the enlightened despot running that operation. But Michael Gove does have some very big shoes to fill, because Fraser Nelson was an extremely successful editor for 15 years, built it into a profitable digital operation, in addition to being a very good editor of the magazine.
We understand he's going to continue writing for it, but it is a change, and it comes, as I said, as a change in the ownership has happened. Tell us about Sir Paul Marshall, and what do you think this appointment might say about the direction the magazine might take?
Well, Sir Paul Marshall is a very successful hedge fund operator in the City of London, Marshall Wace. He's made a lot of money, several hundred million. He has got a stake in GB News. He created the Unheard publishing operation, which has a quite interesting digital presence website. But The Spectator, and you use this phrase, the Tory Bible, I mean, it is the paper that it's way beyond, its influence is way beyond the sheer numbers. I mean, it makes money. It has about maybe 2 million people who read it online, about near just under 100,000. But it's who reads it. And I think Sir Paul Marshall I don't think he's going to be directing Michael Gove. I mean, Gove is not very easily directed. So he will be looking at issues, the economy, supply side reform, how to get growth in this country, economic growth, and obviously the vexed question of immigration. How should that be covered in an intelligent way?
In the short term, a new Conservative Party leader, of course, is to be decided just a few weeks after Michael Gove takes over. How influential is The Spectator then in advising the grassroots on who they should choose, do you think?
Well, I don't think that they will be. It's not going to be a Spectator coronation. Kemi Badenoch, who at one point was the sort of favourite, I believe, work briefly at The Spectator. And it will have influence, I think, more in the party, to a degree in the grassroots, but I'm not convinced that is really where the influence will be exerted. I mean, it's more on policy as opposed to just personalities. But of course, Michael Gove, I mean, he's a bit of a coat of many colors. I mean, he's not that easily controlled, as successive prime ministers found out.
Including a previous editor of The Spectator.
Well, indeed, but I think he could be a very good editor, because he is not predictable, and he's got a good mind. He was an effective education minister, so I think it's a good appointment. And all editors have to go into the sky at some point.
Aha, the man speaking from experience, Lionel Barber, former editor of the Financial Times. Thanks very much. Now, next month, we'll see commemorations across Israel to mark 1 year since the October the 7th attacks. More than 1,200 people died, as well as more than 200 others being taken hostage when Hamas gunmen crossed the border from Gaza, killing indiscriminately. They attacked many dozens of sites, including kibbutzim communities, army bases, and the Nova Music Festival, which was attended by 3,500 young people, hundreds of whom were murdered, while others were tortured and raped. BBC Storyville has been speaking to some of those who survived, piecing together what happened, using footage from that day, including some filmed by Hamas.
A group of people jump out, screaming in Arabic.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
There was a really big explosion, and I flew back. Someone flew on me. And when I finally got up, they came back in, And then they started shooting everyone inside.
That was Eitan, one of the survivors interviewed in the film. I have been speaking to him and to the documentary's director, Yariv Moser, and I asked him what he'd been trying to achieve.
From the 7th of October, I felt that there is a lot of conspiracies and denial on social networks, especially regarding what happened on the 7th of October in Israel when Hamas invaded and started the most horrific terror attacks since the Holocaust. The massacre killed hundreds of youngsters that came to celebrate love, music, and freedom.
And the technique you've used is to take us through minute by minute using different footage. How did you decide what footage to use? How did you decide what needed to be in and what was perhaps too much?
I did want to show what happened from before the party and during and as the attack evolved. So I collected a lot of footage from the survivors themselves, but more than that, I wanted to show the other angle, which means Hamas GoPro cameras that they used during the attack. They wanted to show the world the atrocities that they're doing. They were bragging and enjoying what they did. So I collected this footage as well.
And key, of course, is a testimony of people like Eitan, who we're going to speak to in just a second, survivors, people who experienced it. And I wonder, again, your approach, because people who have experienced this have clearly been through an unimaginably traumatic experience. When you spoke to them, when you approached them, what were the priorities in your mind?
We waited a few months. We wanted to know who is mentally capable to sit in front of the camera and bravely talk about what he had gone through. And I had a psychologist on the set being with the survivors. So it was delicately and sensitively taken care of during the whole period of time.
Well, let's bring Eitan in at this point. Someone who bravely sat down and recounted your experience of that day, Eitan. Did you have any doubts, misgivings before agreeing to take part?
Every second of the way. From the minute that I left my house, got in the car and started driving, at every junction that I saw, I was like, okay, I'm going to turn around. I'm not going to do this. This is too scary. This is too emotional. I don't think I'll be able to actually get through the whole thing. And then I finally get to set and I sit there and I see Ariv and he walked me through the whole story step by step and he got me to talk about it. And it felt good knowing that I may be able to help other people and help my country in some way.
By talking through the events of that day, I hesitate to do this, but I just want, maybe you could briefly tell our audience what did happen to you.
I am one of the survivors of the bomb shelters on the side of the roads next to the party. Large groups of Hamas militants came and they just started murdering civilians in a closed space where we had nowhere to run. We had no weapons to protect ourselves and we had to fight for our lives minute by minute.
And you did. You got out and you escaped. Obviously, some of your friends, some of the people you were with, didn't. I wonder, I mean, they must be in your thoughts. And again, when you were telling the story, you must always think of them as well.
I lost two very good friends of mine in that bomb shelter. We went into the bomb shelter, 29 people. Out of that 29 people, five got kidnapped. If I'm not mistaken, one was murdered on the way to Gaza. And besides that, there were only seven of us that walked out that day and went back to Israel. The rest were murdered in cold blood in a tiny structure begging for their lives.
I saw part of the documentary and you in your testimony say you're not the same person that you were before October the 7th. Have you worked out what sort of person you are now?
I don't think anyone can be the same person after they've gone through something like that. That's a life-changing situation. Everything that happened there, the way everything played out, the things that I was able to do in there and see other people and witness the special and heroic things that other people did. And at this moment, I'm trying to get to a point where I can dedicate most of my time to helping the cause and getting not only the hostages home, but make something happen with the whole situation and try to get my voice out there. And I think telling my story would probably be the best way to do that.
Yariv, if I can come back to you, this is very much a film about individuals like Eitan, who have been through this horrific experience. Clearly, there is a big political context as well. How concerned have you been throughout the process of everything becoming politicized?
I was concerned. I think it's a non-political film. I think it has no connection. Those kids coming to dance at the party had no political intentions. On the contrary, they were partying for peace and love and freedom and other positive values. They were there to have fun. In fact, there were in this party Arabs, Israelis, Jews, Christian, Muslims dancing together with no difference between each other. So for them, it was a call for peace, and they found themselves being attacked by the most evil forces that humanity can create. And I think it's very important to differentiate between the Palestinian people, that we are all want to reconcile and have peace one day in a two-state solution, to Hamas, that are dedicated to jihad and the destruction of the state of Israel and every Jewish person on the planet.
The title is optimistic. We will dance again. Where is the optimism coming from, do you think?
Well, it came from the survivors themselves, and I think that Eitan will say the same. They are all keen one day to come back and dance, be able to overcome this traumatic event. And I think it's also the story of the Jewish people. I'm a third generation of Holocaust survivors. My grandparents always didn't look back, didn't talk about the Holocaust, but looked forward to the future, to a new beginning, new life. This is what we cherish.
Director Yariv Mosen, we heard from Eitan. The documentary Storyville, We Will Dance Again, is available from today on BBC Two and iPlayer from 9 a.m. It's part of a group of programmes marking a year since the October the 7th attacks and the war between Israel and Hamas. A BBC Storyville called Life and Death in Gaza will be broadcast in October. Now, a new study that's been published in the British Journal of Ophthalmology has found that one in three children across the world is short-sighted, and that number, which is growing, is only likely to continue rising. What's going on? Let's speak to Denise Voon, clinical advisor to the College of Optometrists here in the UK. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for having me on.
And it's a pleasure. Which countries are worst affected?
So the ones in East Asia really are the ones that have the most number of short-sighted children. So in Japan, there's 85%, and in South Korea, there's 73%.
And what's going on? Why this increase?
So we think it could be down to a number of factors. I mean, we know that spending time outdoors, at least 2 hours outdoors every day, reduces the risk of developing short-sightedness. And we know that in those countries that I've mentioned, those children are less likely to spend time outdoors and more likely to spend time sort of within their confined houses.
And did things change? And I know in Britain, it's something like 15%, isn't it? Did things change with the lockdowns and kids spending more time indoors and on screens?
Yes, that's what it's looking like. So we think it's probably to do with a combination of things. So they weren't getting that time outdoors. And we're not entirely sure what it is about the outdoors that is so protective for the children in this case. It could be the exposure to natural daylight. It could be that they're doing more exercise, or it could be that they're just focusing at sort of longer distances away. But yes, during COVID, obviously, we weren't really allowed to do that. And children were spending a lot more time indoors.
Are there other things specifically for eye health that parents should be aware of and doing?
Yeah, so probably the biggest thing the College of Optometrists recommend is that you should take your children for regular sight tests. I think that's probably one of the most important things that we can say, because sometimes when children, they don't necessarily know that there's anything wrong. And so it's really important to get that checked regularly.
And how much of this is genetic, something we inherit?
Yeah, that is one of the big factors. We know that the East Asian community are more susceptible to becoming myopic, but we're seeing that the rates are rising in all ethnicities, but we're still, research is quite early in that.
Yeah, and there are differences between girls and boys, I think.
That's right. So again, we're not too sure why this is the case. It could well be because with children, girls tend to develop just that little bit earlier. So we're not sure if it's to do with that. And also, generally speaking, the study did show that the girls were spending less time outdoors. So again, it's spending that time outdoors that seems to be the key.
Get outdoors, although winter is coming, of course. But Denise Voon, clinical advisor to the College of Optometrists, thanks very much. Our closing headline tonight, the UN Security Council is due to debate the escalation of violence between Israel and Hezbollah as Israeli ground forces are sent to the border. The head of the IDF has warned soldiers to prepare for their military boots to enter enemy territory. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami from me and from everyone here on the programme. Have a very good night.
Thank you, James. Studio direction was by Adrian Bargava and the editor was Matthew Symington.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.